This evening, I thought the next section of the book that we're talking about, Mizuno's basic Buddhist concepts, is on the Four Noble Truths. And before we get into that, I wanted to clear up a couple of things, make clear a couple of things about the subject of causality that we've been talking about. And before we move into the Four Noble Truths. First of all, there are a lot of different ways of looking at the idea of karma, and something has come to mind recently that I thought might be useful to emphasize. The law of karma contains or refers to both action, that is what the word karma means, and the results of action. When we're talking about karma, we're normally talking about the whole package, the package of action and result. So what I want to emphasize is the part of the equation that is the results of actions. And we receive the result of those actions on the moral level. It's the result of actions on the moral level, on the moral plane. So, on the ethical or moral plane, we receive those consequences, those results, in the realm of feeling. The realm of feeling is where we perceive that they arrive, that those results arrive. Now, the reason that this is important to recognize is that as we're walking down the street of our life, metaphorically speaking, we're kind of going along in a bit of a cloud. Honestly, most of us are kind of walking along in a bit of a cloud with a fair number of conditionings in action in our experience in life and mind. The stage lights that you get, kind of shining onto the stage for various effects. They have different colored gels in front of them to create different colors on the stage. And our life, we're looking at our life through those different lenses, those different colors. And they condition our way of thinking about our life, the way we experience life. And that conditioning, those different gels, those different lenses that we have across our view of things, is what we call the result of past actions. Some of those past actions are the consequence of habitual patterns that we enact. Some of them are the results of simply past events that have happened and that affect us. And we are, to varying degrees, aware of those filters and clouds that we have over our view of things. So part of what our job in terms of, and in that sense, that's a critical realm that we're looking at in terms of training and that we're looking at in terms of causality. So the causality that we're kind of examining and coming to understand is how those filters get put into place and what we do with them, how we act with regard to them, how we interact with those filters. One person may be able to go through some experience and have it not affect them. Another person may be able to go through the same kind of experience and it will affect them deeply. This is useful to understand because oftentimes our conditioning doesn't really have any significance in terms of our life. Um, I should say that actions or the result of actions can either be good, positive, neutral, or negative. So we can have positive karma, we can have neutral karma, we can have negative karma. The filters in our minds can be positive, negative, or neutral filters. We, you know, presently have a real emphasis on a rational approach to the world in our culture. From the Buddhist, strict Buddhist perspective, this is just a karmic filter, basically. It's just a way of looking at the world. It's no more or less, you know, true in the ultimate sense than any other filter. You know, you could look at the world from a magical kind of point of view. And, you know, fair enough, that's just one way to look at the world. This kind of scientific, rational way of looking at the world is pretty effective. I mean, it produces a lot of stuff for us and makes us kind of comfortable. But in terms of the reality of life, it isn't any more or less true, ultimately, than any other way of looking at things. It's just another way of looking at things. I realize that may not be intuitively obvious, and you may not just take it on faith, but I would ask you to just consider that possibility, that the rational way of looking at things is just another kind of perspective. And in terms of meditation practice, this is significant. This principle, this way of looking at things is significant, because one of the things that we're again trying to do in terms of our meditation practice is the idea of letting things go, letting go of our minds, letting go of the filters in our minds, and being willing to let go of whatever in our minds creates disharmony, creates an obstruction to our experience of the actual reality of life. So as we sit down to meditate, we're in effect, before we sit down to meditate, so we're walking down, again, the road of our metaphorical life here, the metaphorical road of our life, and we have all these different ways of looking at the world, these different experiences which are affecting us. And some of those experiences some of those perspectives we really like, some of them we really don't like, some of them we don't really care about and are kind of neutral about. And so the ones that we like, the experiences, the feelings that we like, we're kind of grasping after them. We're trying to hold on to them. We're trying to fix them in our perspective, in our minds. We like it when people really love us and adore us and all that stuff, so we tend to, kind of try to cultivate that. We don't like it when we feel lousy or people are angry with us, so we try to avoid those things that, you know, kind of make us feel bad or people are angry at us. Most of the time, this works to our advantage. It's a little better to do things that make other people happy and like us than it is to do things that make people angry at us. And that's not a coincidence. That's kind of in accord with some of the truth. But when we hold on to those things, then we can kind of create suffering for ourselves. And what we're really doing is holding on to our own perspective about that. Because we can't really, or we're attempting to do that. Of course, what the Buddha is saying is, well, there isn't really anything there to hold on to. So you're kind of fooling yourself when you're attempting that. And just trying to hold on to things creates suffering for ourselves. So we find ourselves in this situation, I'm suffering, what do I do about it? Come to a meditation teacher and say, I'm suffering, what do I do about it? Learn how to meditate, learn how to let go. Okay. And also part of that is learn what's going on in your mind, study your mind, see what's going on, see where you're holding on. A lot of times we're holding on to our perspectives, our conditioned perspectives from the past, our conditioned feelings from the past. So one of the ideas that you will come across, one of the phrases that you will come across, is the idea of cleansing karma. We talk about cleansing karma in our tradition. And the idea, what this idea is talking about, is learning how to allow the effects of the past to arise, live out their life, and then dissipate. So the idea behind cleansing karma is that we allow the karma to spend itself in our experience, in a sense, without continuing its perpetuation. Because one of the things that happens, and what we talked about in terms of dependent origination, is that there's some event, either that we've done or someone's done to us or something like that. We experience some feeling as a result of that event. And we can then, one of the possible things that can happen, say if it's a negative event, is then to do something out of the consequences of that negative event to produce further negative karma. And this is what we call the perpetuation of negative karma. So somebody yells at you, you feel hurt by that, you get mad, and then you yell at somebody else. And there's the perpetuation of karma. In terms of cleansing karma, what we're talking about is somebody yells at you, you feel the negative consequences of that, you feel the hurt arising in your mind, and you say, okay, I see this in terms of training. I'm going to sit still, and I'm going to let this hurt dissipate, and I'm not going to act in a negative way out of this feeling. This is an example of what we call cleansing karma. It's allowing that feeling to dissipate. Yes?
Also, with that, would you say that, like, kind of exploring that feeling for yourself, you can kind of, I don't want to say assume what's going on for the other person, but you can understand more that it's coming out of more of, like, hurt than it is them actually wanting to hurt you. And so, therefore, you're able to be more compassionate towards them. Why you still be more content with yourself? And I'm just wondering if that's kind of
cheating. One of the possible things that can happen as we sit still with a feeling that arises in our minds is that we get insight into where that feeling comes from, why that hurt arises. It's not inherently the case that if someone yells at you, you will feel hurt. Okay. That's not actually inherently the case. And oftentimes the hurt arises because of some other unresolved issue that we might have. And as you sit with the hurt that arises from someone yelling at you, you then come to understand the workings of causality in your own mind and experience. And from that understanding, you can have a greater sympathy for what someone else may be doing. You might, as you sit with that feeling of hurt, you may come to understand, brain's a little kind of out of it, but you may come to understand where that hurt arises from, and it may arise from a similar kind of situation that you can see in that other person. And so in that sense, compassion can come and all of that stuff. You also have the option of when hurt arises and we're sitting still with it, to just deliberately practice compassion without having the experience of any insight or understanding about what another person is going through, apart from just saying, oh, here's a painful situation for everybody, I'm going to deliberately practice compassion in this situation. I'm going to proactively practice compassion. I'm going to sit still and offer merit to that person. I'm going to take myself out of here because I see that I'm driving them bananas or whatever it is. And that is a decision that we can make. And that decision I'm going to talk about in just a minute from another angle that I wanted to bring up tonight. So just purely from the perspective of the result of actions, so specifically when we talk about that, we're talking about sitting still in the midst of feelings, having them arise and pass away and dissipate. And sometimes we may not immediately come to understand what the cause of the feeling is, or we may never. But part of our practice is to just continue to sit still in whatever feelings are arising with the recognition that they are the result of some past action, which we may or may not see. Sometimes we may do something which irritates someone, and they'll yell at us, and we'll feel hurt way disproportionately more painful than them yelling at us would cause. Like I say, it's not inherently the case that if someone yells at you, you're going to feel hurt. So imagine the situation where someone's yelling, your boss is yelling at you or something like that. You feel hurt and upset. And kind of from an external perspective, you realize, oh, this is really out of shape. Out of proportion to what's going on. One of the things you might conclude is, I'll have to be really careful not to upset that person anymore so that they don't do this again. But what I want to underline is that may be a good idea, but it actually may not be the true cause of the suffering. It may not be the true cause of the hurt. It may not be the true source of the feeling that we're reaping. In other words, the hurt, which is again somewhat out of proportion from what's going on, may be associated to some other prior thing that we've experienced which we've unresolved yet. Okay, does that make sense? So if your mother was constantly yelling at you about something and you carry a lot of baggage from that, which you haven't really looked at yet, and someone in this position, your boss, who kind of looks like your mother or acts like your mother or whatever, yells at you, and you know, there it is again, and there's this kind of big hurt and upset. There may be something you need to deal with regard to your boss, but the real thing is, you know, how do I resolve my relationship with my mother or whatever? Yes.
Could it also be because of a tendency? Not necessarily an individual event or a series of events, but a tendency that you have. You know, this person yelled at me, but I'm so upset because I feel inadequate about this topic.
Yes.
Or this subject, and they actually yelled at me because of that subject, so I'm overreacting.
Yes, that's another example of a way that the immediate event can trigger a bigger thing for you. That you can then learn about or need to learn about yourself. So yeah, that's quite apt here. And so the reason I'm talking about this at this point is to say that. And first, before going there, now our response to this is not necessarily to do any kind of psychoanalysis on ourselves or the people around us. The issue is, how do we continue to sit still in it? Again, what we're trying to learn how to do in terms of practice is learn us a different way of dealing with our minds than we've been taught, than we've learned and we've read about. This is a kind of a different way of dealing with things. We're not trying to dredge up anything in our minds. We're not trying to kind of go out of our way. What we're trying to do is continue to sit still. and allow the meditation and the practice to give us insight into what's going on in our experience and mind. Okay, so I think that's significant, and again, I'll set it aside for a minute and we'll talk about that in more detail in a minute. My brain. Okay, so does that make sense what I'm talking about in terms of cleansing karma, karma as, in this particular kind of narrow way of looking at it, as the result of past actions? Now, one of the elements of this, and an important thing to remember in terms of practice, is the idea of responsibility. And I could say, you know, if I was writing this out, I would say response-ability. In terms of practice, if you took a survey of Buddhists, probably most of them would be responsible people. I mean, one of the things that practicing Buddhism does is encourage you to be conventionally responsible. Responsible, you know, take care of your kids, pay the rent, do the, you know, kind of get to your job on time, all of those things. There, that kind of conventional level of responsibility is just one of the natural byproducts of practicing the precepts. Okay? And is in fact a good thing to cultivate in terms of harmony in the Sangha and all of that. So that conventional level of responsibility, although it can be eschewed, particularly these days, among a certain kind of section of the spiritual population in the world, those people who want to be able to be spontaneous and there's probably another word for it, which I'm forgetting, but creative. And they can kind of think, oh, responsibility is just a
society bringing you down.
Right. is actually a problematic aspiration. But from my perspective, I think in terms of practice, one of the byproducts of practice is actually a responsible life in terms of the people around us and in terms of our responsibilities. But the aspect that I want to talk about today is our ability to respond to circumstances from a deeper place of meditation. Okay. And the reason I'm talking about it today in conjunction with this idea of cleansing of karma is that one of the things that the arising of these filters or karmic effects does is that it impedes our ability to respond to circumstances in a true way. Part of the thing is, again, we're kind of walking down the road and we're in a bit of a cloud, as I said when I first started here. Things are a bit unclear. We're kind of groping through the dark. We're not really sure what to do. This is because of those karmic filters that we carry around with us and that we have yet to shed as a result of our spiritual practice. So one of the ways that we can kind of cultivate this and in a way accelerate the process is to realize that what we're aspiring to do is listen closely to what's good to do in our hearts and to respond to circumstances in our lives from that place. In a way, we can start off with practice, and particularly if you're like in a monastic setting, you can learn the formal aspects of practice and go through the motions of doing the formal aspects of practice. And to a certain extent, this is effective. As lay people, it's a similar thing. You can learn, you can kind of establish a meditation practice, learn about the precepts, keep the precepts in a formal level, learn what to do at the temple, go through the motions, all that stuff. All that's very good and helps you. And in a way, it's like learning the steps of a dance from a chart, you know? You follow the steps according to the chart. and the dance works, more or less. But there's also, if you've ever seen somebody who's really a good dancer, you see that they have enlivened the dance steps. They're doing the steps, but they've enlivened it in some way. There's a marriage between them and the music, them and their dance partner, and they are moving in a way that goes beyond just the rules. And that enlivened quality is what I'm talking about responsibility. So, again, what we are aiming toward is kind of that listening to that place, that deeper place in our hearts. And none of us should expect to be real perfect at this at any time in the near future. I'm certainly not, but it's my aspiration. And it's something that we, in a way, stumble into just as a result of putting our effort into being still and mindful and that sort of thing. But in terms of karma, in terms of cleansing karma, we need to be aware that when we are upset, when we're having, when we're in a snit, when we're having any of the things that we've identified so far as, oh, that's a karmic little thug that's coming through, one of the potential things is that we can miss those subtle cues about what's good to do here. Here's an example of what I'm talking about, although it's not, I don't think it's necessarily exactly karma, but it gives you an example. This evening, I'm sitting in my, I've been feeling kind of lousy lately, something to do with food and my metabolism and all that stuff, and my brain's been a little fuzzy. So I'm sitting in my room reading, and I had this feeling, it's time to go to meditation now. And I'm like, oh, okay. And then I realize, oh, wait, it really is time to go to meditation now. So because I missed that first cue, I came down and I'm late. And that is irresponsible. It's my job to be on time. So my apologies for being late to meditation. And that is a concrete example of what I'm talking about, though, about the fog that we're in and missing the cues and being responsible in the deeper sense as well. Okay, does that make sense? So in terms of, again, in terms of cleansing karma, part of what we need to understand that we're trying to do is see where our karmic impulses would lead us to do something which would create suffering on a perhaps a subtle level, you know, being late, being a minute, 5 minutes late for meditation is not going to be, and probably not going to be an earth-shattering kind of event. It's fairly mild in terms of mistakes, although it was a mistake. But still, in terms of my mind, in terms of cleansing the ability to, really for me on a karmic level, it's being responsible even though I don't feel well. Okay? And not really allowing myself to have the excuse of not being responsible even though I don't feel well. So again, there's a subtle matter there that I need to, again, kind of reorient my direction of my heart and life to this deeper kind of matter. And see where I get slightly taken off track by the kind of fluff of my mind. And it's a personal thing. It's not necessarily something that anybody will kind of notice so much. I mean, obviously, you probably noticed that I was late, but most of the time it's not so necessarily noticeable. And yet it's a significant thing that we can pay kind of close attention to. Sometimes in my position as a monk, I need to be the responsible party. And that can be a bit of a challenge. I remember at one point, I was leading a meditation group evening at one of our meditation groups on the California coast. And we're sitting there in meditation, number of people there, and a man comes in somewhat late for meditation, and someone gets up and is talking to him, and they're making this kind of fuss, so I get up and go and see what's up, and he's pretty much drunk. And so I invite him to, you know, kind of kindly invite him to go outside with me, and we sit down on the bench and talk, and I explain to him, well, I wouldn't recommend coming in at this point. You're kind of drunk and a bit disruptive, not necessarily appropriate for this particular context. And he's like, oh, yeah, thanks. Yeah, you're right. maybe next time or whatever, and then left. And so in a way, we have to deal with the drunk person in ourself. We have to be that wiser adult and see, oh, I'm drunk on whatever it is, and no, we're not necessarily going to head down that road, so let's go this direction. So responsibility is a pretty central idea in terms of our practice, centrally important in terms of our practice, the idea of really listening to circumstances and responding to what is really there, not just from the rules or by rote, although the rules and procedures are useful and are a starting place, but really trying to see what life is asking of us at a particular moment and responding to that. Again, we don't need to get all tied up in knots about it. Most of the time, if we get tied up in knots about it, that's just another karmic fog to work through. But mostly it's just being still and aware and responding as we intuitively feel good about. Does that make sense? Any questions or thoughts?
You mentioned the thing about sort of the rational perspective just being a perspective or lens or filter or whatever. I guess I kind of have maybe a somewhat opposite tendency to what you're sort of addressing there, in the sense of, like, I get that the rational is a lens, and I maybe have tended to like to challenge that whenever possible. And I guess I wonder, what are there pitfalls to watch out for there? I guess I kind of have a sense that there might be in terms of clinging to whatever other thing. But I was just sort of wondering generally what your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, you can cling to any perspective and have that distort your view of what's true or right. It's not in one sense, and that's really the critical thing. It's not that I want to dispute the results of science. Because, you know, they're pretty irrefutable. It's, you know, it works. So, but there is a way that we can hold on to that to the exclusion of other things, and that cuts us off from other things. It's also true that we can kind of bury our heads in the sand and say science is just a perspective, and I believe in this thing. I believe that the shots that you get for immunization shots are evil and don't work, and so I'm not going to have them, and my kids aren't going to have them, and your kids get polio as a result or whatever. You want to be careful of clinging onto another perspective just in response to something about science that you don't like. immunizations, well, they may or may not work, but they make me sick, so I don't like them, so I'm going to kind of invent this thing where they don't really work and they're a plot by the government to, you know, inject us with something, or the pharmaceutical companies, or whatever your deal is. And maybe there's some truth in that, I don't know, but... So, again, the critical thing is just to be mindful of our clinging on to any perspective, and to not, and then to watch out for, like for myself, I think I have a lot of kind of, well, I was thinking recently, the school, the unofficial model of the school I went to college at was atheism, communism, and free love. I didn't necessarily wholeheartedly embrace those three things. I have to understand that there is a part of me that actually did embrace those things.
You're in Portland, so.
There you go. And part of that atheism and communism business is a bit of rebellion to what the man is saying. And I have to recognize that, you know, particularly as a monk, here I am, you know, kind of fully embraced the religious life and got myself into a very hierarchical kind of arrangement in my life and all this stuff, and pretty much kind of eliminated the possibility of free love as well. So, and I have to kind of recognize in my own mind that there's a kind of rebellious quality in my own kind of response from that perspective that's kind of saying the man must be wrong. Any kind of authoritarianism must be wrong. And so I have to kind of watch that tendency in myself and see where I'm responding from that perspective. I don't know what your angle is on the rational world is, but really explore the potential bias of your own kind of the perspective that you feel most comfortable in, and see where that is distorting your view of what another perspective might have. If that makes sense. And that will help you to soften your own views and also see what may be true in that other perspective. Because as I say, you know, I can't really refute much of what goes on in the scientific world. I mean, it's pretty accurate. The thing that I have to be... And also, I come from a bit of a science background. I have to kind of watch out for my own self. Kind of, you know, a lot of what I'm doing is, in one sense, mumbo-jumbo from a lot of scientific points of view. But fair enough, you know, my experience shows me that there's something else here quite valuable. So I'm going to watch out for that skeptical perspective as well. Yes?
I think you told a story one time about someone asked Dogen what he got when he came back from China, and he said something like a soft and flexible mind.
Yeah.
Or was that may be a bad translation of the whole thing, but that sort of reminds me of that story. And it also reminds me, and we've talked about it before, with idealism, you know, your ideals may be correct, and they may have nice effects, and they may do good things for you or for the world, but if you're inflexible to where you wouldn't consider anything beyond your ideals, that's a problem for you.
Right.
I mean, at least in my experience, it's a real hang up.
Yeah.
Or can.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. Exactly. I was listening to a little comedy sketch from George Carlin. And he was really skewering at liberal environmentalists. I happen to be kind of also a liberal environmentalist. So I'm listening. I'm normally, I think George Carlin is quite funny, but I'm listening to him and I'm thinking, wait a minute, this isn't that funny. But what he's saying is actually sort of true. He's saying, you know, the earth, this kind of lampooning this idea of saving the earth. Who really, I mean, human beings have, his point is, you know, industrial human life has been around for 200 years. The Earth's been here for 5 billion. You know, it's it's gone through way worse than what human beings have done to it so far. So it's a little bit of arrogance for a kind of liberal environmentalist to say, we're going to save the earth. And he was kind of really kind of sticking it to us. And he says this kind of really wise point, you know, what they're really saying is, I don't want to mess in my own bed.
Yeah.
That's what the whole kind of thing about liberal environmentalism is. I don't want to have a mess in my own bed. And he's right, you know. So my thing is, I'm going to listen to him with that soft and flexible mind that you're talking about. And I'm going to hear what is the truth here? What is the truth that he's really saying? Because he was really saying something quite true. And I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to not be arrogant about it. I'm not going to cover it up and say I'm going to be saving the earth. I'm going to start saying, no, this is where I live, and I want it to be clean. You know what I mean? I'm not going to abandon my value, but I'm going to soften it, and I'm going to see what is really true, and I'm going to listen to this other perspective. And in that way, then, maybe we can kind of go forward and be more in harmony with what's really true. That makes sense. You have a frown on your face.
No, that makes sense.
Okay.